tonight on Arena. Craig Walker on Auslander, the new album from Power of Dreams, and editors Owen McNamee and Louise Kennedy on Sligo's literary journal, The Cormorant. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. And we start this evening in Sligo, where the inhabitants are in the midst of the Tread Softly Festival. And for a town and a festival steeped in a literary tradition, it's fitting that tonight we're looking at the Sligo literary journal, The Cormorant, named after the bird, described by the late, great Dermot Healy as, quote, a familiar sight along the Sligo coastline, standing sentinel, watching and waiting. Well, I'm hoping that our two editors of this year's Cormorant are standing sentinel in our Sligo studio. Louise Kennedy, author of the much-lauded short story collection The End of the World is a Cul-de-Sac, and novelist Owen McNamee, author of Resurrection Man, The Vogue, The Blue Trilogy, many other novels, much else besides. Louise, I'll start with you. Una Mannion was the first editor of The Cormorant, in fact, but yourself and Owen were brought on board fairly quickly, I think, after those first couple of issues.
Una developed the first Cormorant for the Tread Softly Festival in, I think it was 2018. And I think her vision of it was to have, a very large sort of page that could be folded up, that it would be pocket-sized, something that people could pick up and carry around. And it ended up, with this really quite kind of gorgeous thing for such a simple idea. Yeah. And
it was effectively in its usual manifestation. It's like a big sheet of a newspaper.
Yes,
it's a broad,
absolutely.
A broadsheet, and you fold it, as you say, a little bit of origami for you to get involved in. But you fold it, and effectively what you're looking at in each fold then is one piece of writing, which really defines the word count and puts it up to the writers in terms of economy.
Yeah, it definitely does, because what we ask for. So I think for the first issue, writers were approached because it was going to be part of Tread Softly, which is very much a kind of Sligo festival. And so pretty much everyone who contributed to that very first one, had been living in Sligo or maybe had associations with Sligo at some point. And then after that, Una invited myself and Owen to join her. I think a decision had been made that the submission call would go out kind of more widely. So really we've had submissions from all over the world.
So Owen, what you get then is these submissions from all over the world in or around 250 words. Maybe you might let them go as far as 350 if you're feeling very generous, and it has to fit. And again, if it's a poem, it has to be 25 lines. It has to fit in the space of the folded broadsheet. What we get here is it's a whole range of writers in terms of where they're at in their career. New, old, young, starting out, well-established, the whole shooting gallery.
Yeah, I mean, one of the nice things about it is that we invited established writers in, and that spare thing that the format dictated meant that there's no biographies in it. It's just writers and their names side by side. So, a first-time poet can sit next to, say, Stephen Sexton, all that type of thing. Mm. We didn't set out for it to be a kind of a cutting-edge kind of thing. We took cognizance of community issues and diversity issues and just people that we thought should be encouraged. So it developed its own feel, and it's great when you see it laid out like this. I mean, how well all the work goes together.
And what we're getting in this current issue, this current manifestation, in fact, it's in book form, and it's a selection from the previous broadsheets that you had that were previously published on.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase best of has sort of been bandied around, but it's not actually. It's a very... if like almost kind of a personal selection. I mean, if we could have put every one of them in, we would have, because they were all picked for very good reasons. Yeah. But yeah, it is in book format.
Yeah, it's in book format this time round. But I want to get a sense, really, if we could, Louise, of just what you can get into, a couple of hundred words. So we'll start with one of the pieces that you selected. I was astonished how much comes off this particular piece, Handbag by Rosaline Glennon. Maybe if you just read it first, we'll get a sense of what's in there first of all, Louise.
Yeah. Handbag. This bag was big and black and made of leather. The awkward gold clasp made a clunky sound when it was being opened or closed. She tipped the contents onto the floor. a polo mint, the last one with the silver paper wrapper congealed to it. A bottle of 4711 Eau de Cologne, the kind you tip onto your finger like holy water. A child's bougie wrapped in tissue, a child she had lost, perhaps. Various coins, 2 and 6 pences and a threepenny bit with a hair on it. When Grange Gorman, the mental institution, fell into disrepair and eventually closed down, they found all these handbags in the attic. They belonged to the women who were incarcerated there. Also found were family photos and letters worn at the folds, the words barely legible. A receipt from a dress shop, Cassidy's in Georgia Street, for a taking in alteration made to an already tiny waist. A pair of white gloves with a lace frill. When she opened the bottle of 4711, she could get the scent of her aunt.
It's just extraordinary what she gets in there. That's Handbag by Rosalind Glennon, and part of the Cormorant, the issue of the Cormorant that we're speaking about with editors Louise Kennedy and Owen McNamee this evening. Every sentence kind of pushes the whole thing along, and you're given more and more information each time. It's an extraordinary piece of work, Louise.
Because it's just, I mean, I think as well, because, I mean, there's very little embellishment. It's just built around those details, which are actually, you know, they're quite ordinary, but really because she's used them to build a picture of a life, and a very sad life. I mean, they just actually kill you altogether. Yeah. It's kind of astonishing writing. And Rosaline is a retired person. You know, she's retired from a job. And I think this might have been, if not her first, but one of her first published pieces. And I mean, this is maybe something that's very important to us as well about the Cormorant, is that, you know, this sat in a journal, you know, in that broadsheet, amidst writing by, you know, very established writers and stuff. And really, I think it's the one out of probably all of the things that we've published that's blown me away, because I think it's like 180 words or something.
Yeah.
But as a result of this, Rosalind actually has just completed first year in the Writing and Literature BA in Sligo IT here, which is kind of amazing as well. So, I love that.
Yeah, but, you know, there are a couple of phrases that jump out. The child's booty wrapped in tissue. Suddenly we found out something about the aunt
didn't
know.
Yeah.
And it wakes all of those things up in our memories. Mm-hmm. Or even at the end, who's the narrator here? She could get the scent of her aunt when she opens up the bottle of perfume. I mean, it's just the economy is quite extraordinary in there. And I guess, Owen, many's the writer, you know, many's of the established writer, people like Kevin Barry, Wendy Erskine, and that are in the other parts of the journal. Anybody would be more than happy to be able to get so much into, as Louise put it there, 180 words.
Exactly, yeah. And, you know, that's what I mean about the Cormorant. It's really, really spare, and it's really minimalist in its feel. I mean, I ended up going with... Should I read this?
Yes. Well, I was going to say, why don't you give us one of your selections then, to give us a sense of what spoke to you? Who is this by, first of all?
This is Cara Maxwell, Dogbait, who also came from the BA in Sligo IT, and that's one of the values of the thing that we kind of sort of promoted.
But at a very different part of her life than
yeah, Cara is, I'm not sure she's 25 or 26. She was someone that myself and Una Mannion took aside after a couple of months in the BA and said, do you know how good you are at this? And she looked at us and said, nobody's ever told me I was good at anything in my life before. But it reminds you of that great sort of exchange of letters between Dermot Healy and Seamus Heaney, where Seamus Heaney wrote back to Dermot after he sent his first poems in and said, do you know how good you are? So Cara's first piece that she did for us was published in the Irish Times and was her most read piece in 2019 in the book section by a factor of about 20,000. So,
wow.
Yeah, so she's
good. The piece that you're going to read from Cara that's in this issue of the Cormorant is called Dogbait.
Yeah, it is a kind of lyricism and bite, very much bite. I remember my first sight of Barebone. Zeus, formidable spawn of Rottweiler father and Doberman mother, snatched the skin from my brother's skull while I screamed, Holy Mary, Mother of God, and ran for my granny. Pull a dog's tail and he'll turn. I learnt not to pull tails that day. Speeding towards casualty in the battered Fiesta, tea towels soaked in blood littering the back seat. When I meet an old dog now, I make sure to show my belly. I like my scarlet scalp. Thank you very much. They shot the dog and kept the child. That was stupid. The child should have known better. The dog knew just enough.
Dog Bait by Cara Maxwell. One of the choices by Owen McMeek. Wonderful sense of black humour in there, apart from anything else. But that mention of Zeus at the very beginning, it kind of wrong-foots you, but it sets the story off on a wonderful journey, really, Owen.
Yeah, it does, yeah. The kind of classical reference, but I mean, I think people who own Dobermans are fond of giving them sort of grandiose titles, so it's kind of Rottweilers, yeah.
What about, you know, given that from the two pieces we've already had an example of, the quality is in there, it must be incredibly difficult to weed out material when it comes to choosing for the actual broadsheet version itself, where the space is absolutely limited. You can't go over what's available to you on that particular sheet of paper. Are there many rows when it comes to the choosing, the choices, Louise?
No, I wouldn't say rows. I mean, it's kind of interesting that, you know, we come up with, I suppose, what could be broadly called a long list really quickly. And then the sort of definitelys and maybes and stuff like that, there'd be a little bit of negotiation at the end, but it's not too bad. I mean, there's generally a consensus, really.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if someone really wants to push for a piece, then that goes in. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's part of the consensus, if you like. So, mm-hmm. It's been pretty easy. We haven't had a row yet.
No, we haven't. We're also speaking to each other.
Yeah.
And do you know, it's probably really fair to say as well.
Are you both in the same studio right now?
We are, actually. Yeah.
Okay. We are. Across the table from each other, which is kind of mad. I think we both want to say as well, though, that that really Una isn't around at the moment. Mm. But Una should be here.
Una Mannion.
She's away because, I mean, this is really her vision, and she does the vast majority of the work as well, and does it also beautifully and with so much commitment and stuff as well. So I just wanted to get that in.
Fair enough. Yeah. Let's have a listen to another piece, a choice of yours again here, Louise. Mm-hmm. The Amusements by Bernie McGill. Mm-hmm. She creates, again, very short piece, she creates an entire world for us in this piece. Let's have a listen.
Oh yeah, this is great. It's called The Amusements. Eve works at Redemption. It's where they put the new girls, where customers come to cash in their tokens for prizes. Cuddly toys and keychains, fridge magnets, jumbo bags of squishy marshmallow sweets. It's also the place for lost children. Eve is not allowed to touch the lost children. She has to ask their names and be reassuring, but she must not lay a hand on them, even if they throw themselves on the ground and pound it with their fists. She has to make an announcement to ask the relatives of Hannah or Abigail or Gabriel to come to Redemption to reclaim their child. She has to smile a lot and act like she's enjoying her work. It's better than being on the Orbiter, where Joy works. Joy has her own packet of vomit powder that she has to scatter on the ground to absorb the sick, and her own mop for other accidents. All the cute boys are on relief. They're trained in all the rides, so if it gets busy or if one of the regulars can't make a shift, a relief boy takes over. Eve reckons she's in with a shot with the ginger-haired freckled guy. He smiled her way a couple of times on his way to the Turtles. She reckons Hope has her eye on him too. Hope is one of the cafe girls. She has a face on her that says, "I'm better than this." Hope and Joy are close. If Eve does well, she could be moved to horses or the photo booth or the slip. It's something to strive for. Nobody wants to be stuck always working at Redemption.
And that's The Amusements by Bernie McGill, one of the pieces that's in this year's version of The Cormorant. Editors Louise Kennedy and Owen McNamee speaking to me about it this evening. I just love all of these various places and the status that's attached to each of the stations in this particular amusement park. Poor old Joy and the vomit
with their packet of vomit powder. Oh yeah, shocking, isn't it? Yeah, but it's just I think there's something really quite surprising about it, because that opening line, "Eve works at Redemption," it sounds kind of religious, and then you realise that you're basically at some place like Barry's in Portrush. It's great.
Yeah, and also the ginger-haired freckled guy. I really want to hear the sequel to it. Who actually ends up getting with the ginger-haired freckled guy? And I want to know.
I think my money's on Hope. In fairness.
But quite clever, you know, as you say, though, even in their choice of names, everything mm-hmm. has to have value. Hope and Joy and Eve, there's mm-hmm. a kind of a biblical sense to those names as well, I suppose.
And even like, yeah, all the cute boys are on relief. It's fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Poetry, of course, does feature as well on, and you actually chose a poem as one of your selections for us from Rary Branley.
Yeah, and actually I don't have it in front of me, sure. But the reason I picked Mary Bradley's piece was that it was a link back to, if you like, she dedicates it to Leland Bardwell, the poet and novelist.
Well, I tell you what, I have it here in front of me, so why don't I read it for you, Owen, seeing as you had the little bit of COVID chaos. As you say, Tenebrae is the name of the piece, In Memoriam Leland Bardwell, June 20th, 2016. Lessons of darkness taught by the Russians. Mandelstam, back from the Gulag in his dog hair coat with "She'd tell me where to cut the line." His wife, Nadezhda Chekhov, from the mantelpiece, deaf to our chorus. Sad-eyed lady of the lowlands, way past midnight. A tattered proclamation on the bathroom door and the Via Dolorosa in black. Sorrowful mysteries scoured for hours. The father, cryptic crosswords, the sun. And that's Mary Branley's poet, which I did, a poem that which I did not do justice to. It's a very complex piece of writing, and the way those lines and words run into each other there, Owen.
Yeah, I mean, it's a poem of textures. I mean, it's what it does, I suppose, is it hunts down beauty on the edge of meaning. Or, as Dermot Healy used to say, sometimes I put the meaning in and sometimes I take it out again. You know, that's that. And it's all about the feel and the textures of the world, of the words. And I mean, I presume that Mary has placement in mind and places in mind there. And she brings them into them in a very abstract way. But there's something quite beautiful about it.
Yes, yeah. And again, was there something specific about Mary's relationship in terms of Leland Bardwell as a writer? Was there something there? Did you find out anything about that? Again, you don't have room to explore this on the sheet itself.
No. Although, I mean, one of the reasons I included it was that relationship to Leland Bardwell and that whole sort of time of Maharau. Mm. And I suppose it's interesting, I mean, that's 20-odd years ago, and there was the same level of, if you like, sort of cultural and psychic energy in Sligo as there is now. There was a dip in between, if you like. It was much wilder then. I kind of have to say that it was kind of wilder in a misbehaving kind of way, but there was something of kind of people taking things to the edge. I think it was something to do with the tide.
Yeah,
the times, and sometimes falling over the edge.
Yeah, a wildness in the creativity rather than just, you know, good time being had by all.
Yeah, well, the good time was had as well, but it's a lot more civilised now, I think.
In fact, you were very kind in your words, Louise, earlier on about Una Mannion, but mm-hmm. it was Una Mannion was a large part of encouraging you to write as well, wasn't it?
Oh yeah, totally. Una and another friend of ours, Rose Jordan, who wanted to set aside some time every week to write, set up a writing group. Yeah, and I got kind of bundled into a car and dragged to it one night. And in 2014. So yeah, I'd never written or intended to write or anything. So yeah.
Have you had a go at the remit for the Cormorant, saying to yourself, do it in 250 words or thereabouts? Have you tried it?
Actually, the three of us, so myself and Owen and Una, have had a piece in the very first issue. But then when it came to choose work to put in the book, we thought that when, you know, we couldn't include everything, then it would be atrocious behaviour to
first three to
include ourselves. So we left ours out. So yeah, I think mine was like 265 words or something in the very first one. Yeah,
right. Okay. We'll get you to give us your final selection. And you know, of course, you'd read all of them if we had time for that. But this one kind of surprised me as well, because I had to look twice that it's Michael Nolan who's mm-hmm. writing here, because I was kind of wrong-footed in the reading of it. Mm-hmm. I don't know whether that's intentional or not, mm-hmm. as to who the speaker is here.
Yeah.
Maybe you'd read it for us. He called me all sorts of things.
Mm-hmm. There are no family photographs on his Facebook page, only high-resolution shots of him standing in fields alongside men wearing flat caps, dogs sitting calmly at their feet. He's a country gentleman now, kitted out in a game bag and dummy vest, watching a quietly efficient trail dog stride across the grass with a floppy-necked pheasant clutched between its teeth. The photographer knows what she's at. She's taken a side profile of him standing with his hands in the pockets of his tweed hunting coat. He has the same build, same facial structure I dream about those nights when I wake up sweating. But if I zoom in and look closely, I can see the looseness of the skin around his neck. His hair is grey, the corner of his right eye creased with crow's feet. He's squinting in the brightness, but also sort of grimacing, as if trying to concentrate on what's happening in front of him, yet his thoughts are elsewhere. In another photograph, he's reclining on his elbow amongst the reeds, as if posing to be painted at a Roman banquet. One person has commented, "Playboy." It's exactly the kind of thing he would do, and therefore much less disturbing than the image of him clutching the top of his country walking stick with both hands, pouting. I'm embarrassed for him, the same way I'm embarrassed for myself every time I'm confronted with a camera. My first instinct is to pull a face, but when I do, I expose myself more than if I just smiled.
That's Michael Nolan's piece. He called me all sorts of things. What I found extraordinary about that, I kind of presumed it was a female voice speaking in the paragraph itself, but there's so much suggestion of malice, of something really nasty going on behind the scenes here. Extraordinary that Michael has managed to get that in there.
Yeah. I think he does it. There's something that he does. I don't know. It almost reads to me like autofiction. You know, because really, it's you know, the way that Annie Ernaux does this and just sort of tells what happened and what she's looking at. And I think because this is what you're getting. But then, of course, you know, writers don't do that. You know, there's a lot of control and a lot of thought put into what's presented. And I just think that it's done in a very understated way. And as you said, it just conveys this this really uncomfortable menace.
Yeah, and you, I really want to know more about who is speaking to me here and what happened in the past. And I guess that's what Michael's intentions were. At least I hope that's what they were.
Yeah.
Do you have your other selection in front of you, or did COVID chaos get
I'm,
you?
I'm afraid it's up to you, Sean.
Oh, it's up to me again for baby hair. Do you know what? I won't inflict that on everybody again. But maybe tell. I loved about this was it's exploring. It gets a touch into Irish and the kind of the etymology of words. The word that we're looking at is pathacon.
Yeah, it is. It's Marion Dowd, Baby Hair. It's an extraordinary piece. And if you like, it's almost a kind of a found word, a recorded word, misunderstood, which evolves into the Irish word for leveret. But she attaches it to lost babies, if you like. I think, was it never child is a phrase that she used.
Yes.
And it attaches to killeens, if you like, the burial places of unbaptised children, stillborn children, and of course then in a broader sense into chewing babies. But there's something, you know, the father would place the baby at night in these killings and these burial grounds, and something about that stealthiness of it that's composed in the poem, and the gentleness, the very idea of the leveret.
Yeah, an extraordinary piece, and as I say, I would want to read it a few times before I'd read it on air, because it deserves.
I have it here, Sean.
Oh, well, why don't you give us then, and we'll finish
on
with
Louise's
that.
Phone. We're improvising here.
That, lovely stuff. Thanks.
His pupils had collected a basket of words given to him by neighbours, which his black pen tipped neatly into a page in 1935. Pokarion, Pookdeg, push a hair, push a pan, push a hat on. Repeat it, because the source would have been unfamiliar to him. The original Irish chewed up and spat out in varying forms. Now, over 80 years later, the root word was unfamiliar to me too. With fair but fading book Irish, I twisted and turned the sounds, trying to seek out the mother from mother form. Unsuccessful, I turned to one better versed in the tongue. He proffered patacon, meaning levered a young rabbit. That didn't quite make sense. Old dictionaries were in agreement, but also offered plump little creatures and weak young boy. At first this seemed more likely, but as the weeks passed, leveret took hold. Leveret, a way of creating distance between a never child and the community. A word that deluded the father's shame for allowing his newborn to die unbaptized. A word that absorbs some of the mother's grief. Less awful to pass a fairy fort encircling the bodies with live leverets than a waste field choked with dead babies. Patacon, a word used in parts of 1950s lives for babies who died before baptismal waters had cleaned their souls. These lost little lost leverets soaked in original sin were buried in unconsecrated ground, stranded forever in the grey nothingness and nowhere of limbo.
That's Marion Dowd's piece, Baby Hair, read for us there by Owen McNamee, one of the editors of this year's issue of The Cormorant. He was speaking to us along with Louise Kennedy, who was also with us this evening. Thanks both for being with us, Louise and Owen. And The Cormorant is available on the Tread Softly website, treadsoftly.ie. Craig Walker is a name that'll be familiar to fans of Irish guitar music from the 1990s. As frontman of the Dublin band Power of Dreams, he signed his first major record deal while still a teenager. The band reunited virtually over the last year and have just released their first album in over 25 years. Delighted to be joined by Craig Walker this evening from Berlin. You were still at school, Craig, when Power of Dreams were being courted, when the band were courted by record companies back, I suppose, at the end of the 1980s into the beginning of the 1990s. I know we all probably have rose-tinted spectacles when back at certain parts of our youth, but do you feel that that was a particularly golden time for Irish music in some way?
Hi, Sean. Yeah, absolutely. I think it was, you know, it was the first wave after U2 becoming the biggest band in the world in the kind of late 80s. So there was a lot of focus on Irish music. There was suddenly lots of A&R people and lots of bands getting signed. And it was a really, really kind of fruitful period, and lots of great bands like The House and many others that, you know, were just making great music.
Yeah, and you mentioned U2 there, and it was one of the things that was constantly said at the time, you know, particularly about Power of Dreams. Power of Dreams will be the next, they are the next U2. It must have been quite tiresome at the time when you were, you know, a teenager going into your 20s when you wanted to be the thing, not never mind the new something else. But as the years have gone on, would you feel differently about that comparison perhaps?
Absolutely. I mean, I loved you too. That's the funny thing. I ended up kind of like having a go at them because of what you said. You know, I was doing tons and tons of interview, and every interview would get to the YouTube question inevitably, no matter where it was, wherever in the world. And you know, being a cocky kind of 18-year-old, I really thought, I'm not going to play the game and attack them, but. Absolutely. I mean, they put focus on the Irish music scene like we'd never seen before, you know. I mean, we had Tin Lizzy before them, but never on the level. I remember seeing Red Rocks on the Tube when that first aired, and just being like, wow, that's an Irish band. Absolutely killing.
And to be fair to you two, they'd probably say they didn't want anybody to be the next you two. They wanted the next generation to be the next generation, not to try to emulate them. But let's move on to today and the Power of Dreams giving us Ausland, the new album. To what extent, and there's a kind of a sadness in some ways in this, Robbie Callan, Robbie's death. Just how did Robbie's death, would you say, feed into the decision to make this new album?
Well, we'd already made the decision, but he died in the middle of the recording, and I was actually, you know, about to send it. Like, he would have played on the record if he hadn't died, for sure, because it was such a, you know, there was such a big gap between records, and spent a lot. Like, I went back, like, during lockdown when the decision was made to make the album. I really went back into that stuff, you know, in the album, like for material for the records. So I was really looking at stuff that I really hadn't looked at for many, many years. And he would have, of course, you know, been a part of that. He's there in spirit, I think, you know, and it was a real shocker. He was, you know, I turned 50 last year as well. So I'm at that age where people start dropping off 50s and people around you. And he was the first, like, person that I'd had a very kind of long relationship in music, and you know, he was a couple of years older than me, and he was so, you know, when I was 15 he was 17 when we met, and he had already, you know, he had a rehearsal studio in the back of his house. I thought this guy was unbelievably together, you know, and was a real influence. And I thought, I can do that, you know. And he was great at giving confidence. And he comes from a theatrical family, and you know, that was something new for me. I've never been around people from theatre, you know. So
I'll tell you, let's have a listen to one of the tracks from the new album, because I think some of the lyrics in this are very interesting, given that the rock and roll lifestyle that you had certainly had for a couple of years. Let's have a listen to "You Haven't Really Lived."
I can feel the sun still beating, coming down through the pouring rain, opens closed chapters in my brain.
Haven't Really Lived, the title of that track there from Auslander, the new album from Power of Dreams, and Craig Walker speaking to me from Berlin about the album. First of all, just when I play that, it brings me right back to the 1990s. And I think that was your intention, Craig. You weren't going to run away from the type of music that you made as Power of Dreams.
Absolutely not. I mean, when the producer of the record, Eric Alcock, who's my partner in my project that we had to put on hold when lockdown happened, I asked him to do the record, and he'd never heard of the band. He's a lot younger, like 12 years younger than me, from Canada, had no reference to the band, and he went back and listened to it, and was really into it. You know, he said, "I'm really surprised that, you know, it's aged really well. The music's great." So when we started producing the record, I was sending him stuff, and he called me up and he said, "Listen, I could pile loads of stuff onto this. I could make it sound like, you know, really modern and put loads of, you know, stuff, interesting stuff on it." But he said, "What's the point? You know, like, it's, you know, the band's got a sound which we had from the get go, and it's great fun. I mean, for me, if I was to make an album that was, you know, if somebody makes an album and they say they're not from the 90s, and they're kind of making a homage album, it doesn't, like, I would never do that, you know.
Yeah.
So it's great to be able to go back and revisit the 90s and be absolutely fearless about it, and not thinking, not worrying what people are going to say, because you can say, "Well, we were there."
Yeah, no disagreement from your brother Keith, who was the drummer with the band, and he's part of the album, and Ian Olney, who is the guitar player.
Sure.
Yeah, they were both in agreement. Let's go back to what we were doing in the 1990s, rather than pretend we are something else, or we were something else.
Completely. And I mean, Ian has got such a distinct guitar sound and style, you know, that it was just a real pleasure to work with the guys again, because, you know, we were recording remotely. It's the first time most people have ever done albums like this. But, you know, I was in Berlin, the producer was in another part of Berlin, and Keith was in Arizona, my brother, doing the drums, and Ian lives in London. So it was all kind of all over the place, and it came back. But when Eric put it all together, it sounded like Power of Dreams. That was what made it work, you know. If it didn't sound like Power of Dreams, we wouldn't have released the record.
And we should also mention the keyboard player and the mixer on the album, Ali Satin, who's the fifth member of the current incarnation, if you like. And yourself and Keith, and you've often spoken about this, that there was a touch of the Gallagher brothers about you at times in terms of disagreement. But I suppose a few decades passing, are you both a lot more sanguine and easier going about things now?
Kind of. we still have our moments. I think anyone that's ever been in a band with a sibling will understand that you know you can get away with saying stuff to siblings in a rehearsal room that you would never say to another member of the band, and that's a blessing and a curse in the same way, you know, because things get said and kind of, you know, me and Keith was 14 when we started the band, or 11 when he got his first drum kit and I got my first electric guitar, and we were sharing a bedroom, so like we started making music from that age together. So it's been amazing to go back. I'm really proud of his drumming on the album. I think he's done an amazing job.
If you were teenage siblings who didn't have a row, there'd be something wrong with you, let's face it.
I know.
I was just talking about the lyrics on the song that we just listened to there, You Haven't Really Lived. And I talked about, you know, certainly you were really fetid in those early years, and I'm sure there was a big rock and roll lifestyle, but there's a line in there, you haven't really lived till you've sung The Drugs Don't Work to a Room Full of Addicts, until you've loved someone else for who they are. They sound like the words of a wise man, either who learned a lot along the way or who was lucky enough not to get damaged along the way.
A bit of both. I had my battles in the past, which I thankfully got sorted. And that was actually written in a rehabilitation centre. I did sing The Drugs Don't Work in a rehabilitation centre, and so it was a real thing. But the song is just saying it's amazing where music can take you. You know, like it's taken me to the weirdest places, to the greatest places, and you know, moments like that when you're in a rehabilitation centre and you're singing The Drugs Don't Work to a Room Full of Drug Addicts is quite ironic.
Was that a difficult time in the rehabilitation centre?
It was something I had to do, you know, the rock and roll thing is kind of thrown at you and presented to you as soon as you enter into it, and you know everything's free, and it's easy to kind of just get into the situation where you're struggling with it, you know. It's over and over again. You spend the most of your time on the tour where, you know, drinking and drugging is just like part of that's what people do. So we were so young, you know, we're lucky that we survived it. I mean, all of us went through kind of periods of going a bit crazy, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, but you know, why not do in your early 20s if you can? But we're lucky. Yeah, we're all lucky that we got out of it.
I wanted to finish up with the title track of the album, Craig, Auslander, because to me it really echoes back to that debut album, the debut album that you know got you so noticed. The debut album was called Immigrants, Emigrants and Me. Auslander is kind of like an echo of that in many ways. Just explain the word first of all, and what the song is about.
Sure, Auslander means foreigner in German. And I've been living in Berlin for the past 6 years. And during that period, there's been a massive influx of refugees into the city. And you know, one of the studios that I work at is in Tempelhof Airport, which is a magnificent building in Germany. You know, it was Hitler's favorite building. It was Hitler's airport. But in the top of that, they've built three. The place is so vast, you could fit like hundreds of venues in there, and they don't. But there's three studios in that complex on the top floor. And at the same time as I was recording, there was 5,000 refugees housed in one of the bottom floors. Mm-hmm. And I just thought, so you know, what an amazing kind of. If Hitler could only see this, you know, the refugees from all over the world, living in his favorite building. So it was formed by that, but the connection to the first album was really important, because originally the idea was to just do an album like it acknowledged the 30th anniversary, which was last year, of Immigrants, and we were just going to do an acoustic version of that album or a few tracks from that. And then COVID happened, and it just felt like this is an opportunity to do something new. And the title ties in with that. I was kind of between, on the first record, I didn't know whether I was going to stay in Ireland because, you know, things weren't great then, career-wise for people. And then, fast forward 30 years later.
Here we are with the new album. Well, listen, don't be leaving it another 25 years before the next album now, Craig.
Absolutely not.
Now that you're back out there. Great to speak with
you. And thank you, Sean.
Thanks a million. That's Craig Walker. And here is that title track, Auslan.
Our grey faces glare at me. push me back in back orders. I walk alone through an unkept garden, scorched by history's bombs. The Black Eagles.
There we go. Auslander, the title tracker from a track rather from Power of Dreams. Not the title track. Power of Dreams is the band, and Auslander the title of the album as well. Staccato is the inaugural exhibition of a new contemporary art space, the Kenmare Butter Market in County Kerry. The exhibition features the paintings of three abstract landscape artists, Bridget Flannery, Paul Hughes and Paddy Lennon, in a huge light-filled space, 2,200 square feet in all. The building itself has a fascinating history. It was an open-air market, a whiskey distillery and a dance hall in its day. Staccato is curated by Emer O'Connor, took time away from her day job as the resident director of the Tyrone Guthrie Centre at Anna McCarrick and Monaghan to work on this show, and I'm delighted to say that Emer O'Connor joins us on the phone this evening, as does Bridget Flannery, one of the three artists involved. This space, first of all, Emer, in Kenmare, it sounds, and from what I've seen from the pictures online, it looks absolutely gorgeous and amazing.
It is absolutely a stunning space, really beautifully done out by the owners, stunning. And of course, you know, the first time I saw it, when I went into it to put the show in, but that's another discussion. It's a space to be absolutely proud of, wonderful for Kenmare.
Yeah, and great that we're getting a contemporary gallery springing up, you know, outside of the main urban centres, that it gives people a chance to see work like this in different parts of the country as well. Why have you called the show Staccato, Emer? What does that tell us about what you were looking to do?
Well, I called it Staccato because when I looked at the three artists' work, to put it succinctly, I could hear it. I could hear the colour in it. I'm a trained musician myself. And I found myself asking each artist whether or not they worked to music. And each artist actually does work to music. So it's just something about the musician in me. And that idea of there's different scales in the show, scale of work. And Paul works on very large scale, and Paddy and Bridget work to medium, large, medium and quite small scale, which reminded me of the notes on the stave. And as a trained musician myself, I just thought it was an interesting way to describe how the hang might look as the viewer moved around.
Well, let's go to Bridget then and speak to the specifics of some of the images that you've put into the that's part of your contribution to the exhibition, Bridget. And we're going to tweet these images as Bridget speaks to us about them. You can follow us on @RTE Arena if you want to see the images as we speak. I'll talk about strand walking evening first of all, if I can, Bridget, and picking up on what Emer said there. Tell me a little bit about, well, first of all, describe the image to me, and we can talk about the musical aspect of it afterwards. Describe what we see in strand walking evening.
Hi, Sean. Thank you for having us on. This is a painting. It's acrylic and collage on board. And it has, I suppose, a range of tones and colours that are almost autumnal, or that remind me and bring people into the idea of kind of late evening, just before things get you know, too dark. And there's that certain richness in the light, particularly at this time of the year, you know, that autumnal light. So the colours are yellows and plums and kind of smushed reds, and then there's a dark line that goes across our horizon. Underneath the paint are two collaged image shapes, and I've sanded into the paint so that some of the edges of the shapes come
yeah.
through.
Yeah, even
so
even
there's it, always that.
Yeah, even as I look at it, even as I look at it on a computer screen, you can get a sense of the texture of the collage underneath it, kind of pushing out the acrylic in many ways. And you found working with acrylic, you kind of, it, I don't know if it was that you got fed up with oils, but acrylic suddenly spoke to you in a way that oil didn't, Bridget.
Well, the happiest day of my life was the day I discovered acrylic paint. I was, you know, as a young artist, I was very, 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 impulsive. And yeah, I still am impulsive in my work. But I found that oil paint just was too slow for me. Also, my face just came out in splodges and I looked as if I was crying constantly. Maybe I had an allergy to it. Perhaps I did, yeah, I don't know. But somebody said to me that acrylic would probably suit my personality better and that it dried quickly and that I could really tear into it in a very much more controlled way than I could with oils. And I've been working on it ever since.
Eimear mentioned music when she was talking about giving Staccato as the title to the exhibition. Was there music involved in the making of the image that we're looking at, Strand Walking Evening?
Yeah, that particular series, that is one of a larger series of work. And I was listening to a lot of work by, I listened to a lot of contemporary art music. And I was listening to a lot of work at the time by Benjamin Dwyer and by Ryan Malloy, two Irish contemporary composers. Yeah. And there was something in both of their work that had that sense of that end of the day, little bit melancholic, just a little a little hint of melancholy, but also that richness of colour as well.
Eimear, were you tempted to have some kind, or maybe you do have some kind of music happening within the Kenmare Butter Market as people walk around and look at the various paintings, both of Bridget's, Paul Hughes's and Paddy Lennon's?
Yes, it was kind of in the curatorial hope for the show, but I'm not sure whether it happened or not in the end. There was a huge amount of work because this was the inaugural show for the exhibition, so there was a huge amount of work going on in the background to get the show up off the floor and onto the walls. And whether or not the music actually happened, I don't know. But in actual fact, really, it doesn't need music. Yeah. The paintings themselves are full of music. They really are.
Yeah, and anyway, there are 50 paintings, so 50 pieces
sure
of music.
Are. Enough to keep you amused, exactly.
Yeah, but the 50 pieces of music all at the same time might be slightly problematic, let's face it. Let's look at a second image of yours, if we could, Bridget. And this is a piece called, I can't find it here in front of me, I beg your pardon. Yes, Bone Bright Winter Day. Again, we have a sense of the seasonal in this. Describe the image to us, Bone Bright Winter Day.
The painting is, again, it's acrylic and collage on birch ply, and it's 40 by 40 centimetres, a square format, which I very much like. And the it's almost evenly broken into, it's almost divided in two. The top half has a very strong, very, very, very strong orange, very pulsing orange square shape in it. And then the bottom half has a much cooler, white that has a little hints of grey in it. And again, there's two shapes that are collage shapes that are coming through on the surface.
Yeah, almost looks like the wood of the board, the grain of the wood of the board that we can see underneath. That comes across through that and a real feeling of winter of it. Just as we finish up, Eimear, the last time you were on with us, December 2020, I believe, you were speaking to us about your book, Art, Ireland and the Irish Diaspora. It has won an award since, the inaugural Lawrence J. McCaffrey Award. That must have been a little bit of joy for you.
Well, that was extraordinarily exciting because us art historians never win awards. So it was with the American Conference for Irish Studies out in America, and I was absolutely delighted, as my publisher, Irish Academic Press. It was a real surprise and a real honour.
Yeah, and of course it's not surprising that it should have that US connection, given that it was speaking precisely about that and paintings across from Chicago, Dublin, New York, and all in the period 1893 to 1939, looking at all sorts of connections there. Great to have spoken with both of you this evening. Thanks very much to Eimear O'Connor there, and indeed Bridget Flannery, who was speaking to us as well about that exhibition, Staccato, which runs at the Kenmare Butter Market 7 days a week right through until August the 20th, and you can find out full details on kenmarebuttermarket.org. That is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields and Leah Murphy researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound this evening. Tonight's programme produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.